Disc 25. Unlike other contemporary politicians, Burr enjoyed the nitty-gritty of such campaigns and embraced the electioneering they disdained. No other member of the founding generation would have explained his fondness for elections by stating that they provided a great deal of fun and honor and profit. That spring, Burr ran a campaign that, with its exhaustive toolbox of techniques, previewed modern political methods. Federalists had benefited from a requirement that voters needed to own substantial real estate. To bypass this, Burr exploited a legal loophole that enabled tenants to pool their properties and claim that their combined values qualified them to vote. He sent German-speaking orators into German-speaking areas. Burr also infused his passionate young followers with uncommon zeal at a time of haphazard campaigning. They drew up lists of voters in the city, with long columns of names accompanied by thumbnail sketches of the voters' political bent, finances, health, and willingness to volunteer. With his campaign workers knocking on doors to solicit funds, Burr dispensed canny tips about potential donors. "Ask nothing of this one," he would say. "If we demand money, he'll be offended and refuse to work for us." Double this man's assessment. He'll contribute generously if he doesn't have to work. However aristocratic his lineage, Burr was a proponent of the hard sell and shrewdly sized up his targets. He also scented victory on several topical issues, denouncing the Alien and Sedition Acts and the unpopular taxes levied to finance Hamilton's army. Burr's generalship, perseverance, industry, and execution exceeds all description, Commodore James Nicholson told Albert Gallatin. He was as superior to the Hamiltonians as a man is to a boy. That April, New Yorkers out for a stroll could have stumbled upon either Alexander Hamilton or Aaron Burr addressing crowds on street corners, sometimes alternating on the same platform. They treated each other with impeccable courtesy. Neither seemed to have any hesitation about soliciting voters individually or in small groups. One Republican paper could scarcely believe Hamilton's strenuous campaigning as he rallied the faithful like a general marshaling men for battle. "Hamilton harangues the astonished group. Every day he is seen in the street, hurrying this way and darting that. Here he buttons a heavy-hearted Federalist and preaches up courage. There he meets a group and he simpers in unanimity. He talks of perseverance and, God bless the mark, of virtue." The Federalist papers professed similar shock at seeing the patrician Burr working the Manhattan sidewalks, one paper asking how a would-be vice president could stoop so low as to visit every corner in search of voters. Burr opened his home to his workers, serving refreshments and scattering mattresses on the floor to allow quick naps. One New York merchant recorded in his diary, "Colonel Burr kept open house for nearly 2 months, and committees were in session day and night during that whole time at his house." Burr displayed similar professional stamina during the 3-day polling period. To guard against any Federalist vote tampering, he assigned poll watchers to voting stations and kept a 10-hour vigil at one venue. A local congressman told James Monroe, "Burr is in charge. To his exertions, we owe much." He attended the polling places within the city for 24 hours without sleeping or resting. To turn out the vote, he organized a cavalcade of carriages, chairs, and wagons to transport Republican sympathizers to the polls. For 3 days, Hamilton was no less assiduous, mounting his horse and riding from place to place, mobilizing supporters and enduring shouts of "scoundrel" and "villain" in Republican precincts. By midnight on May 1st, 1800, the local political world learned the result of this fierce election, one that portended a fundamental realignment in American politics. The Republican slate had swept New York City, converting Hamilton's own home turf from a Federalist to a Republican stronghold. This meant that Jefferson could now count on 12 electoral votes where he had received none in 1796. Since he had lost to Adams then by only 3 votes, this shift was a real thunderbolt. Burr took justifiable pride in his triumph, explaining to one downcast Federalist that "we have beaten you by superior management." Theodore Roosevelt later interpreted Burr's victory as that of the skillful ward politician, with a mastery of the petty political detail over the statesman like Hamilton. But Hamilton had not hesitated to dip into the humble mechanics of politics. A shaken Hamilton and fellow Federalists attended a May 4th caucus that was infiltrated by the Republican press. The Aurora said that the despondency of those assembled verged on the melancholy of despair. Those present were so petrified at the thought of Jefferson as president that they meditated desperate measures. Led by Hamilton, they decided to appeal to Governor Jay and have him convene the outgoing state legislature to impose new rules for choosing presidential electors. They now wanted the electors chosen through popular voting by district. Most shocking of all, they wanted this new system applied retroactively to overturn the recent election. In heated arguments over the proposition, the Aurora noted that when it was urged that it might lead to a civil war, a person present observed that a civil war would be preferable to having Jefferson. Hamilton's appeal may count as the most high-handed and undemocratic act of his career. A year earlier, Burr had championed a proposal in the state legislature to scrap the existing method for selecting presidential electors. Instead of having the legislature elect them, they would be elected by the people on a district-by-district basis. The Federalists had hooted this down, but now Hamilton had the gall to revive the idea. On May 7th, he warned Jay that the recent election would probably install Jefferson, an atheist in religion and a fanatic in politics, as president. He portrayed the Republican Party as an amalgam of dangerous elements, some favoring the overthrow of the government by stripping it of its due energies, others a revolution after the manner of Bonaparte. Hamilton's acknowledged that Republicans would unanimously oppose his measure, but that in times like these in which we live, it will not do to be over-scrupulous. It is easy to sacrifice the substantial interests of society by a strict adherence to ordinary rules. This from a man who had consecrated his life to the law. Henry Cabot Lodge said of this irreparable blot on Hamilton's career, "The proposition was, in fact, nothing less than to commit under the forms of law a fraud which would set aside the expressed will of a majority of voters in the state." Hamilton seemed oblivious to the contradiction in asking Jay to resort to extra-legal means to conserve the rule of law. A politician of strict integrity, Jay was dumbstruck by Hamilton's letter, which he tabled and never answered. On the back, he wrote this deprecating description: "Proposing a measure for party purposes which it would not become me to adopt." Jay's silence was an apt expression of scorn. How had Hamilton justified this disgraceful action to himself? He believed that Jefferson's support for the Constitution had always been lukewarm, and that once in office, he would dismantle the federal government and return America to the chaos of the Articles of Confederation. This was not entirely paranoid thinking on Hamilton's part, for Jefferson made statements that sounded as if he wanted an annulment or radical recasting of the Constitution. "The true theory of our Constitution," Jefferson told Gideon Granger, "was that the states are independent as to everything within themselves and united as to everything respecting foreign nations." The application of this theory would have canceled out much of Hamilton's domestic system. Yet by this point, Hamilton should have known that Jefferson's rhetoric tended to outpace reality and that a wily, pragmatic politician lurked behind the sometimes overheated ideologist. Within days of the New York election, Burr felt within his grasp the prize he coveted, the Republican nomination for vice president. As a reward for the New York victory, a congressional caucus in Philadelphia decided that the party's vice presidential candidate should come from that state. Although consideration was given briefly to George Clinton and Robert R. Livingston, Burr had masterminded the victory, and his followers exacted their due. A heavy load of mutual distrust between Jefferson and Burr was temporarily set aside. Burr remembered that during the previous presidential campaign, Virginia Republicans had pledged to support him and then given him only lackluster backing. For his part, Jefferson later admitted that he had employed Burr as a slippery tool to further his ambitions in 1800. "I had never seen Colonel Burr till he came as a member of the Senate," he would write. "His conduct very soon inspired me with distrust. I habitually cautioned Mr. Madison against trusting him too much." Only Burr's bravura performance in the New York elections had secured his place on the ticket. When I destined him for a high appointment, Jefferson continued, it was out of respect for the favor he had obtained with the Republican Party by his extraordinary exertions and successes in the New York election in 1800. Jefferson had no true respect for Burr, much less affection. Their partnership was to last as long as it served their mutual interests, and not a second longer. Hamilton always believed that the Federalist defeat in New York City in the spring of 1800 had thrown John Adams into such a fright about his re-election prospects that he decided to purge his cabinet of Hamilton loyalists in order to court Republican votes. On May 3rd, the day the news arrived, Jefferson saw that the election results had indeed dealt a horrendous blow to Adams. "He was very sensibly affected," Jefferson reported, "and accosted me with these words, 'Well, I understand that you are to beat me in this contest, and I will only say that I will be as faithful a subject as any you will have.'" John Adams later claimed that in May 1800 he had experienced a sudden epiphany and discovered Hamilton's malevolent control over his cabinet. But he had harbored such thoughts all along, and rumors of impending cabinet firings had flitted about since the previous summer. George Washington had handled cabinet infighting in a forceful, dignified fashion, as when he tried in vain to impose a truce in the anonymous newspaper war between Hamilton and Jefferson. By contrast, Adams had sputtered and railed and done nothing. "Adams was contemplative and something of a loner," wrote John Ferling, "whereas Washington was an aggressive, energetic businessman farmer who read relatively little and was happiest when he was physically active. Washington had a command over his subordinates and a subtle knowledge of their true nature that Adams never managed to achieve." Increasingly, Adams had accused Pickering and McHenry of being tools of Great Britain who opposed his French peace initiatives, and he excoriated them openly. Treasury Secretary Wolcott told a colleague in December 1799 that President Adams considers Colonel Pickering, Mr. McHenry, and myself as his enemies. His resentments against General Hamilton are excessive. He declares his belief at the existence of a British faction in the United States. With his selective memory, Adams sometimes forgot having made such defamatory remarks. Federalist George Cabot told Wolcott that the president denies that he ever called us a British faction. He does not recollect these intemperances and thinks himself grossly misunderstood or misrepresented. House Speaker Sedgwick supplied Hamilton with similar anecdotes of the president belittling his Federalist colleagues and subordinates. "He everywhere denounces the men in whom he confided at the beginning of his administration as an oligarchish faction." Adams noisily upbraided his cabinet, Sedgwick said, telling them that they cannot govern him, and that this faction, and particularly Hamilton, its head, intends to drive the country into a war with France and a more intimate union with Great Britain. Fisher Ames said that Adams went on in this vein like one possessed. The image of a wrathful Adams, prone to temper tantrums, was not the invention of Alexander Hamilton, and he was far from alone in finding Adams agitated, intemperate, and subject to violent fits. Congressman James A. Bayard of Delaware told Hamilton that Adams was liable to gusts of passion little short of frenzy, which drive him beyond the control of any rational reflection. "I speak of what I have seen. At such moments, the interest of those who support him or the interest of the nation would be outweighed by a single impulse of rage." The Republicans disseminated a similarly unflattering view of an irascible Adams. Jefferson recalled how Adams shouted profanities at his cabinet while storming around the room and dashing and trampling his wig on the floor. And Jefferson's tool, James T. Callender, assailed Adams in a string of essays collected into a book entitled The Prospect Before Us. "The reign of Mr. Adams has been one continued tempest of malignant passions. As president, he has never opened his lips or lifted his pen without threatening and scolding." Callender got 9 months in jail for his tirade, which had been modestly subsidized by Jefferson. The latter denied any involvement until Callender later published a clutch of telltale letters that Jefferson had written to him. Many high Federalists who constituted Hamilton's wing of the party preferred Charles Cotesworth Pinckney as their presidential standard-bearer. An Oxford-educated lawyer from South Carolina, a southern state with a significant merchant class, Pinckney had risen to brigadier general during the Revolution and later attended the Constitutional Convention. His candidacy possessed powerful symbolic value on account of his role in the XYZ affair and his position as Hamilton's senior partner in the recent army. Pinckney's admirers, however, knew that they could hardly dump a sitting president and would have to settle for him as vice president. After Federalist congressmen caucused in Philadelphia on May 3, 1800, they decided that to support Adams and Pinckney equally is the only thing that can possibly save us from the fangs of Jefferson, as Hamilton wrote. But if Pinckney received more votes than Adams in his native South Carolina, he could easily become president instead of vice president on the Federalist ticket. Adams saw the Pinckney boomlet as a thinly veiled ploy by Hamilton to replace him with someone more tractable to his wishes. Hamilton now regarded Adams as unstable and thought Pinckney had a more suitable temperament for the presidency. His preference for Pinckney was a risky strategy, since Adams was an incumbent president, and Americans were scarcely clamoring for Charles Cotesworth Pinckney. So when Adams inaugurated his cabinet purge on May 5, 1800, it was not so much that he had just discovered Hamilton's control over his cabinet in a flash of light. Rather, he was alarmed by the realization of his own weakness as a candidate, as evidenced by the New York elections that week. One can scarcely fault Adams for cleansing his cabinet of mediocre or disloyal men, and he should have fired them a lot earlier. But he conducted the firings in an autocratic manner that led to a political bloodbath, widened the discord in Federalist ranks, and confirmed Hamilton's doubts about his unbecoming behavior. The firings started on May 5th when Adams summoned the unwitting James McHenry from a dinner party. The Irish-born McHenry had been an inept Secretary of War. He was a sensitive, mild-mannered man who wrote poetry and retained a lilt in his voice. As a cabinet member, McHenry had been unnerved by the president's mercurial moods and capricious judgment. He once said that whether Adams was sportful, playful, witty, kind, cold, drunk, sober, angry, easy, stiff, jealous, cautious, confident, close, open, it was almost always in the wrong place or to the wrong persons. At first, Adams pretended that he had yanked McHenry from the dinner party to discuss some inconsequential War Department business. Then, as McHenry was leaving, Adams erupted in a furious monologue about Hamilton and the New York election and accused McHenry of conspiring against him. Against all evidence, Adams accused the indefatigable Hamilton of having sought a Federalist defeat in the New York election. A dumbfounded McHenry said, "I have heard no such conduct ascribed to General Hamilton, and I cannot think it to be the case." To which Adams replied, "I know it, sir, to be so, and require you to inform yourself and report." Then Adams unleashed a memorable volley. "Hamilton is an intrigant, the greatest intrigant in the world, a man devoid of every moral principle, a bastard and as much a foreigner as Gallatin. Mr. Jefferson is an infinitely better man, a wiser one, I am sure, and, if president, will act wisely. I know it, and would rather be vice president under him or even minister resident at The Hague than indebted to such a being as Hamilton for the presidency. You are subservient to Hamilton, who ruled Washington and would still rule if he could. Washington saddled me with three secretaries who would control me, but I shall take care of that." This monologue went on and on. Adams faulted McHenry for not having forewarned him that Hamilton would materialize in Trenton the previous fall, charged him with incompetence in running his department, and mocked the notion that McHenry might know something about foreign affairs. "You cannot, sir, remain longer in office," he concluded. McHenry was shocked less at being sacked than by Adams's indecorous and at times outrageous behavior. He told his nephew that the president sometimes spoke in such a manner of certain men and things as to persuade one that he was actually insane. McHenry had just bought an expensive home in Washington, D.C., the federal district where the government would shortly move, and the firing cost him dearly. Nonetheless, he fell on his sword and resigned the next day. Adams later expressed remorse at having wounded the feelings of McHenry, but Hamilton knew that McHenry was not the only one who felt the president's anger. Most, if not all, his ministers and several distinguished members of the two houses of Congress have been humiliated by the effects of these gusts of passion, Hamilton wrote. For years, McHenry licked his wounds. Later on, upon reading Adams's defense of his administration, he commented to Pickering, "Still, in his own opinion, the greatest man of the age, I see Adams will carry with him to the grave his vanity, his weaknesses, and follies, specimens of which we have so often witnessed and always endeavored to veil them from the public." 5 days after expelling McHenry, Adams wrote to Timothy Pickering and tried to induce the Secretary of State to tender his resignation. A former adjutant general in the Continental Army, the Harvard-educated Pickering was too ornery to be controlled by anyone, even Hamilton, who acknowledged something warm and angular in his temper. He had tenaciously supported the Alien and Sedition Acts and proved an unyielding opponent of the Paris peace mission. Abigail Adams described Pickering as a man whose temper is sour and whose resentments are implacable, while her husband found him shifty-eyed and ruthless. A man in a mask, sometimes of silk, sometimes of iron, and sometimes of brass. For Adams, Pickering had been Hamilton's main henchman in his cabinet and an object of special detestation. A confirmed abolitionist, Pickering so admired Hamilton that he later tried his hand at an authorized biography of him. Mr. Pickering would have made a good collector of the customs, but he was not so well qualified for a Secretary of State, said Adams. He was so devoted an idolater of Hamilton that he could not judge impartially of the sentiments and opinions of the President of the United States. When Pickering received Adams's note, he refused to give him the satisfaction of resigning. So Adams cashiered him in an act he called one of the most deliberate, virtuous, and disinterested actions of my life. After 3 years of dealing with Adams at close quarters, Pickering circulated many stories about the president's unreserved venom for Hamilton. Once, when Colonel Hamilton's name was mentioned to Mr. Adams, who hated him, Adams said, "I remember the young bastard when he entered the army." Adams complained to Pickering that in accepting Hamilton as Inspector General, the Senate had crammed Hamilton down my throat. Pickering believed that Adams feared Hamilton as a rival of superior talents and intelligence. Adams's loathing of Hamilton grew so visceral, Pickering said, that the mere mention of his name seemed to be sufficient to rouse his sometimes dormant resentments, and it is probable that he hoarded up all the gossiping stories of Hamilton's amorous propensities. Adams's ouster of the two Hamiltonians produced jubilation among Republicans and led some Federalists to wonder whether that was not the real point of the exercise. Pickering thought the clumsy firings were part of a deal that Adams cut with Republican opponents who would support his re-election to the presidency, provided he would make peace with France and remove Mr. McHenry and me from office. The Federalist press echoed this theme, with the Federalist of Trenton explaining Adams's conduct as the result of a political arrangement with Mr. Jefferson, an arrangement of the most mysterious and important complexion. The repercussions of Adams's firings were enduring. Combined with his simultaneous disbanding of the new army, Adams's actions touched off a vindictive, mean-spirited mood in Hamilton, who now said of the president, "The man is more mad than I ever thought him, and I shall soon be led to say as wicked as he is mad." Beyond his own injured vanity and thwarted ambition, Hamilton regarded Adams as playing a duplicitous game, and he preferred an honest enemy to a dishonest friend. "I will never more be responsible for Adams by my direct support, even though the consequence should be the election of Jefferson," Hamilton told Theodore Sedgwick. "If we must have an enemy at the head of the government, let it be one whom we can oppose and for whom we are not responsible." Hamilton was congenitally incapable of compromise. Rather than make peace with John Adams, he was ready, if necessary, to blow up the Federalist Party and let Jefferson become president. The stream of personal abuse directed by Adams at Hamilton only made a bad situation worse. On June 2nd, McHenry sent Hamilton a confidential letter giving the unexpurgated version of his May 5th confrontation with Adams, complete with presidential references to Hamilton's bastardy and foreign birth. Hamilton was as sensitive as ever about his illegitimacy, especially after a Republican newspaper in Boston warned him that the mode of your descent from a dubious father in an English island would bar any pretensions he might have to the presidency. Hamilton must have winced at this and quickly drafted a letter to an old wartime comrade, Major William Jackson. "Never was there a more ungenerous persecution of any man than of myself," Hamilton began. "Not only the worst constructions are put upon my conduct as a public man, but it seems my birth is the subject of the most humiliating criticism." Hamilton then furnished the only account he ever left of his parentage, telling of his father's chronic business troubles and his mother's marriage to Johann Michael Levien and subsequent divorce. He lied pathetically when he said that his parents had married, but that the union was rendered technically illegal by the terms of his mother's earlier divorce. With more than a dash of wounded pride, he added, "The truth is that on the question who my parents were, I have better pretensions than most of those who in this country plume themselves on ancestry." Instead of sending the statement to Jackson, Hamilton showed it to James McHenry, who gave him wise advice. "I sincerely believe that there is not one of your friends who have paid the least attention to the insinuations attempted to be cast on the legitimacy of your birth, or who would care or respect you less were all that your enemies say or impute on this head true. I think it will be most prudent and magnanimous to leave any explanation on the subject to your biographer and the discretion of those friends to whom you have communicated the facts." That someone of Hamilton's elevated stature felt obligated to defend his birth at this stage of his career suggests how harrowing it must have been to hear of Adams's constant digs at his upbringing. After McHenry and Pickering were dismissed, Hamilton was emboldened to go further with his plans to strip Adams of the presidency. Most Federalists balked at opposing Adams, but some warmed to the idea of dropping a vote for him here and there and giving the edge to his running mate, Charles Cotesworth Pinckney. That June, Hamilton sounded out Federalist opinion during a 3-week tour that he made to New England under the guise of saying adieu to his crumbling army. In reality, it was a vote-getting campaign for Pinckney. In Oxford, Massachusetts, Hamilton reviewed a brigade and expressed an unequivocal approbation of the discipline of the army and beheld with pleasure the progress of subordination and attention to dress and decorum, a Boston paper reported. At moments, the tour seemed a sentimental version of Washington's farewell from the Continental Army. At Oxford, under a flag-draped colonnade, with a backdrop of martial music, Hamilton threw a dinner for his outgoing officers. After toasting Washington's memory, Hamilton gave a talk that suffused every cheek and showed the agitation of every bosom. Hamilton's progress was tracked by a watchful Republican press. The Aurora told readers that Hamilton was traveling with well-known aristocrats, and when their carriage broke down in Boston, the paper construed this mishap as a portent of the downfall of aristocracy in the United States. Hamilton must have felt he was riding high when he was honored by an adulatory dinner in Boston that included almost every Federalist of importance in the state. "The company was the most respectable ever assembled in this town on a similar occasion," said one paper. Everywhere he went, Hamilton conjured up disturbing images of a French-style revolution in America, even telling one listener that it did not matter who became the next president, because he did not expect his head to remain 4 years longer upon his shoulders unless it was at the head of a victorious army. This sounded like scare talk, but Hamilton actually believed these overblown fantasies of impending Jacobin carnage in America. Spending the summer and early fall in Quincy, John and Abigail Adams understood the political agenda behind Hamilton's mission. "Quite understandably, John Adams became so consumed by anger against Hamilton," said Fisher Ames, "that he was implacable against him and used language that was bitter even to outrage and swearing." Abigail disparaged Hamilton as the little cock-sparrow general and described his trip as merely an electioneering business to feel the pulse of the New England states and impress those upon whom he could have any influence to vote for Pinckney. For Abigail, Hamilton was impudent and brazen-faced, an upstart next to her husband. She derided Hamilton and his followers as boys of yesterday who were unhatched and unfledged when the venerable character they are striving to pull down was running every risk of life and property to serve and save a country of which these beings are unworthy members. This seemed to overlook Hamilton's valor on many Revolutionary War battlefields. Increasingly, John and Abigail Adams pinned a new conspiratorial tag on Hamilton and his followers, branding them the Essex Junto. These supposed plotters, many of them born in Essex County, Massachusetts, included Fisher Ames, George Cabot, Benjamin Goodhue, Stephen Higginson, John Lowell, and Timothy Pickering. As Hamilton's trip progressed, it was something less than the triumphal tour he had expected. He declared snobbishly that the first-class men were for Pinckney and the second-class men for Adams, but he encountered more of the latter than he bargained for. Many Adams supporters told Hamilton bluntly that if he persisted in trying to elect Pinckney, they would withhold votes from him to guarantee an Adams victory. Bruised by his brushes with Adams, Hamilton was deaf to these warnings. An incomparable bureaucrat and master theoretician, he had no comparable gift for practical politics. The most striking example of Hamilton's maladroit approach came when he lobbied Arthur Fenner, the Rhode Island governor. Fenner said that Hamilton showed up at his home, grandly surrounded by a retinue of colonels and generals, and instantly broached the topic of the presidential election. Hamilton stressed that only Pinckney would have broad support in both the North and South, and that Adams couldn't be reelected. Fenner turned on him hotly. "I then asked him what Mr. Adams had done that he should be tipped out of the tail of the cart." Fenner lauded the peace mission to France and praised the comeuppances of McHenry and Pickering. "Adams is out of the question," Hamilton insisted to Fenner. "It is Pinckney and Jefferson." After years of painting Thomas Jefferson as the devil incarnate, Hamilton suddenly preferred him to John Adams, again showing that both Hamilton and Adams had lost all perspective in their rages against each other. Impervious to criticism, Hamilton had embarked on a mad escapade to elect Pinckney, and it was bootless for friends to warn him that he had started a dangerous vendetta. Visiting Rhode Island that July, John Rutledge, Jr., a Federalist congressman from South Carolina, heard nasty scuttlebutt about Hamilton. "Many Rhode Island residents," Rutledge informed Hamilton, "are jealous and suspicious of you in the extreme, saying that your opposition to Mr. Adams has its source in Private Peake. If you had been appointed commander-in-chief on the death of General Washington, you would have continued one of Mr. Adams's partisans. You are endeavoring to give success to General Pinckney's election because he will administer the government under your direction." Although several associates warned Hamilton that his lobbying campaign was backfiring, he did not heed them. He had drawn all the wrong lessons from his peregrinations through New England and decided that he would have to enlighten benighted voters to the manifold failings of John Adams, and he would do so by the method that he had employed throughout his career at critical moments— a blazing polemic in which he would lay out his case in crushing detail. Chapter 36. In a Very Belligerent Humor. In writing an intemperate indictment of John Adams, Hamilton committed a form of political suicide that blighted the rest of his career. As shown with the Reynolds pamphlet, he had a genius for the self-inflicted wound and was capable of marching blindly off a cliff. Traits most pronounced in the late 1790s. Governor Morris once commented that one of Hamilton's chief characteristics was the pertinacious adherence to opinions he had once formed. Hamilton found it hard to refrain from vendettas. He would be devoured by dislike of someone, brood about it, then yield to the catharsis of discharging his venom in print. The frankness of his nature was such that he could not easily avoid the expression of his sentiments of public men and measures, and his extreme candor in such cases was sometimes productive of personal inconveniences, observed friend Nathaniel Pendleton. Even Eliza, in after years, conceded that her adored husband had a character perhaps too frank and independent for a democratic people. So long as Hamilton was Inspector General, he had stifled his pent-up anger against Adams. But by July 1800, his military service had ended, and he could gratify his need to lash out at the president. He would repay all the snubs and slurs he had suffered, all the galling references to his bastardy. Once McHenry and Pickering were fired, Hamilton did not simply commiserate with them, but encouraged them to preserve internal papers that would expose the president. "Allow me to suggest," he told Pickering, "that you ought to take with you copies and extracts of all such documents as will enable you to explain both Jefferson and Adams." Pickering encouraged the project that Hamilton meditated. "I have been contemplating the importance of a bold and frank exposure of Adams. Perhaps I may have it in my power to furnish some facts." Suspecting that Adams and Jefferson had sealed a secret election pact, Hamilton told McHenry, "Pray favor me with as many circumstances as may appear to you to show the probability of coalitions with Mr. Jefferson which are spoken of." Hamilton ended up with the cooperation of the discontented cabinet members, including the one member of the triumvirate who had avoided the purge, Oliver Wolcott Jr., the capable if unimaginative Treasury Secretary. Even though Adams thought Wolcott more loyal than McHenry and Pickering, Wolcott considered the president a powder keg. Of Adams, he told Fisher Ames, "We know the temper of his mind to be revolutionary, violent, and vindictive. His passions and selfishness would continually gain strength." Wolcott deprecated Adams's peace overtures to France as a mere game of diplomacy designed to court votes. At moments, however, Wolcott grew ambivalent about the idea of Hamilton exposing Adams, arguing that the people already believe that the president is crazy. In the end, though, convinced that Adams would ruin the government, Wolcott told Hamilton that somebody had to write a few paragraphs exposing the folly of those who had idealized Adams as a noble, independent spirit. Thus, in his massive indictment of Adams, Hamilton drew on abundant information provided by McHenry, Pickering, and Wolcott about presidential behavior behind closed doors. Hamilton knew that the three would be charged with treachery by Adams, but he thought his pamphlet would forfeit all credibility without such documentation. Stories about Adams's high-strung behavior, if legion in high Federalist circles, were little known outside of them. Hamilton also wanted to stress the mistreatment of cabinet members, lest readers dismiss his critique of Adams as mere personal pique over the disbanded army. Adams was duly shocked by the confidences that his ex-cabinet members betrayed. "Look into Hamilton's pamphlet," he told a friend. "Observe the pretended information of things which could only have passed between me and my cabinet." In these revelations, Adams saw patent treachery and perfidy. By early August, Hamilton was in a fighting mood. On July 12th, the Aurora printed yet another article accusing him, the morally chaste and virtuous head of the Treasury Department, of having devised a corrupt system of controlling the press and government employees while in office. Hamilton was so offended by this interminable nonsense that he told Wolcott he might institute a libel suit. "You see, I am in a very belligerent humor." Just how belligerent was already clear on August 1, 1800, when the hot-headed Hamilton composed an extraordinary letter to the president. All summer, Hamilton had chafed at reports that Adams was branding him a British lackey. Now he wrote to the president in peremptory terms. "It has been repeatedly mentioned to me that you have on different occasions asserted the existence of a British faction in this country, embracing a number of leading or influential characters of the Federal Party, as usually denominated, and that you have named me as one of this description of persons. I must, sir, take it for granted that you cannot have made such assertions or insinuations without being willing to avow them and to assign the reasons to a party who may conceive himself injured by them." Hamilton demanded the evidence behind these statements. As Adams would have known from the phraseology, Hamilton was, implausibly, commencing an affair of honor with the President of the United States. Many duels began with such imperious demands for explanations of purported slander. Adams did not answer the letter because of its insolent tone. Perhaps he also knew that it would be difficult to substantiate his accusations. Hamilton, too, must have realized that he would be rebuffed by Adams. On October 1st, he sent a follow-up note to Adams, calling the allegations against him a base, wicked, and cruel calumny, destitute even of a plausible pretext to excuse the folly or mask the depravity which must have dictated it. This was shockingly offensive language to use with the president and terminated all possibility of future contact between the two men. Once launched upon a course of action, the combative Hamilton could never stop. As Federalists speculated about his upcoming open letter, prominent party members had misgivings. George Cabot told Hamilton that a careful, well-tempered critique of Adams might tip the balance toward Pinckney, but he thought it was too late for the Federalists to abandon Adams altogether. He feared that Hamilton would go to extremes and only excite jealousy and discord. "Although I think some good may be derived from an exhibition of Mr. Adams's misconduct," Cabot wrote, "yet I am well persuaded that you may do better than to put your name to it. This might give it an interest with men who need no such interest, but it will be converted to a new proof that you are a dangerous man." The wavering Wolcott also warned Hamilton that his letter might breed divisions among Federalists, but he pressed on undeterred. Hamilton did not seem to foresee that his anti-Adams pamphlet would prove so sensational. At first, he conceived of it as a private letter that would circulate among influential Federalists in New England and especially South Carolina, where he hoped electors might give the edge to Pinckney over Adams. What he did not anticipate was that his letter would soon be purloined and excerpted by the Aurora and other hostile Republican papers. How did they gain access to Hamilton's circular letter? Historians have tended to finger Burr, who obtained a copy and provided extracts to selected newspapers. In fact, the ubiquitous John Beckley, who leaked the Mariah Reynolds pamphlet, may have been the conduit to the Aurora. Republicans knew that publishing Hamilton's letter would deepen the rift in the Federalist Party. Beckley gloated over Hamilton's faulty judgment and hoped his letter would deal the coup de grace to his career. Vainly does he essay to seize the mantle of Washington and cloak the moral atrocities of a life spent in wickedness and which must terminate in shame and dishonor, Beckley told a friend. The president's nephew, William Shaw, confirmed that the pamphlet had been immediately sent to Beckley at Philadelphia, the former clerk of the House of Representatives, who caused extracts to be reprinted in the Aurora, through which medium it was first made known to the public. The appearance of juicy passages in the Aurora and other Republican papers forced Hamilton to revise his plans and publish his letter openly in pamphlet form. He preferred that people read the entire document rather than portions selectively culled by his enemies. Among other things, Hamilton's pamphlet was his riposte to Adams's failure to acknowledge his challenging letter. So, contrary to his usual practice of anonymous publishing, Hamilton knew that, as a man of honor, he had to sign his name boldly to the document. The 54-page pamphlet was published on October 24, 1800, while Hamilton was arguing a case before the New York Supreme Court in Albany. Instead of the letter being restricted to specific localities, it was now broadcast to a national audience. In the Reynolds pamphlet, Hamilton had exposed only his own folly. In the Adams pamphlet, he displayed both his own errant judgment and Adams's instability. An elated Madison wrote to Jefferson, "I rejoice with you that republicanism is likely to be so completely triumphant." William Duane, the Aurora editor, exulted that the pamphlet has done more mischief to the parties concerned than all the labors of his paper. The Federalists were no less staggered by Hamilton's folly. Noah Webster said that Hamilton's ambition, pride, and overbearing temper threatened to make him the evil genius of this country. Condemnation of the pamphlet echoed down the generations, even among the most admiring Hamiltonians. Henry Cabot Lodge labeled the open letter a piece of passionate folly, which, coming on the eve of a close and doubtful contest for the presidency, was simple madness. The bulk of the letter from Alexander Hamilton concerning the public conduct and character of John Adams, Esquire, President of the United States, is a petulant survey of John Adams's life and presidency. The author presented a tale of growing disenchantment with a man he once admired. "I was one of that numerous class who had conceived a high veneration for Mr. Adams on account of the part he acted in the first stages of our revolution." However, in the early 1780s, while Hamilton served in Congress, Adams had shed his halo as he displayed the unfortunate foibles of a vanity without bounds and a jealousy capable of discoloring every object. He He described the Adams presidency as a heterogeneous compound of right and wrong, of wisdom and error. While granting that Adams was a fair theorist, he criticized his handling of the peace mission to France, told how he routinely overrode cabinet members, and recounted the humiliating censures and bitter reproaches meted out to James McHenry. Not content to catalog wrongs done to administration members, Hamilton made the mistake of reviewing his own personal grievances. He complained that the president had not named him commander-in-chief after Washington's death, and cited sources that Mr. Adams has repeatedly indulged himself in virulent and indecent abuse of me, has denominated me a man destitute of every moral principle, and has stigmatized me as the leader of a British faction. Such special pleading made Hamilton appear petty and vengeful, more a self-absorbed man seeking personal vindication than an upstanding party leader. The final section of the pamphlet seemed particularly absurd. Having pummeled Adams for dotty behavior, he then endorsed him for president and advised electors to vote equally for Adams and Pinckney. If Federalists stayed united behind these two men, he predicted, they would increase the probability of excluding a third candidate of whose unfitness all sincere Federalists are convinced, namely Jefferson. For a man of Hamilton's incomparable intellect, the pamphlet was a crazily botched job, an extended tantrum in print. In his sketch of Adams, it must be said, Hamilton only repeated what he had seen and heard. Adams certainly was not mad, as Hamilton alleged, but he had given way to numerous instances of profane and inappropriate behavior. There had been raving and cursing, indecent comments, and loss of self-control. Hamilton reiterated criticisms that Jefferson, Franklin, and others had made privately about Adams and synthesized them with observations from cabinet members and other Federalists who had witnessed the president's oddly changeable behavior. Joseph Ellis has written that, despite Hamilton's political prejudices, he effectively framed the question that has haunted Adams's reputation ever since. How was it that one of the leading lights in the founding generation seemed to exhibit such massive lapses in personal stability? Some Federalists certify the accuracy of the Adams portrait. Benjamin Goodhue of Massachusetts saluted Hamilton's courage. "We have been actuated by a pernicious policy in being so silent respecting Mr. Adams. The public have been left thereby to form opinions favorable to him, and of course unfavorable to those who were the objects of his mad displeasure." Charles Carroll, a former senator from Maryland, likewise sang the letter's praises. The assertions of the pamphlet, I take it for granted, are true. And if true, surely it must be admitted that Mr. Adams is not fit to be president, and his unfitness should be made known to the electors and the public. I conceive it a species of treason to conceal from the public his incapacity. Still other Federalists, such as William Plumer of New Hampshire, said sotto voce what Hamilton had the temerity to trumpet in print. "Mr. Adams's conduct in office in many instances has been very irregular and highly improper. The studied neglect and naked contempt with which he has treated the heads of departments affords strong evidence of his being governed by caprice, or that age has enfeebled his mental faculties." Those siding with Hamilton composed a small minority of politicos. Most Federalists and all Republicans understood that the extended tirade against Adams made Hamilton look hypocritical and woefully indiscreet, especially when combined with the Mariah Reynolds pamphlet. Robert Troup said that Hamilton's letter had been universally condemned. In point of imprudence, it is coupled with the pamphlet formerly published by the general respecting himself, and not a man in the whole circle of our friends but condemns it. Our enemies are universally in triumph. Only something little short of a miracle could now stop Jefferson from becoming president, Troup feared, and he had little doubt that the pamphlet would sharply erode Hamilton's influence among the Federalist faithful. At the other end of the political spectrum, Jefferson also believed that the tract dealt a mortal blow to Adams's chances for re-election. At first, Hamilton was caught off guard by news that his private letter would be widely circulated, but then he professed pleasure. Like Adams, he was blinded by pride. George Cabot told Hamilton that even his most respectable friends faulted him for displaying egotism and vanity in the publication. When Troup said he dreaded the impact on the Federalist cause, Hamilton insisted that it was being read with prodigious avidity and would be productive of good. Hamilton had departed so far from common sense that he solicited new anecdotes from McHenry and Pickering for a revised, expanded edition, even though McHenry had been shocked to see Hamilton print his stories without permission. Oliver Wolcott Jr. was so alarmed about the projected update that he goaded McHenry into writing a letter that pointedly advised Hamilton against any such move. Hamilton reconsidered, and no new edition appeared. Without question, Adams was correct in not dignifying the pamphlet with a response. "This pamphlet I regret more on account of its author than on my own, because I am confident it will do him more harm than me," he told a friend, while reviving his bizarre accusation that Hamilton had tried to blackmail Washington by threatening to publish pamphlets upon his character and conduct. For Adams to have responded publicly on the eve of national elections would have only aggravated turmoil in Federalist ranks. Abigail Adams privately mocked Hamilton with epithets often applied to her husband and derided his weakness, vanity, and ambitious views. Adams did compose a refutation of Hamilton's letter, but then let it gather dust in the drawer. He was no more capable of long-term silence than Hamilton, however, though he waited until after Hamilton's death. The manner of Hamilton's dying did not faze Adams, who said that he would not permit his character to lie under infamous calumnies because the author of them, with a pistol bullet through his spinal marrow, died a penitent. In 1809, Adams undertook an elaborate justification of his presidency in The Boston Patriot. The series continued almost weekly for 3 years, and Adams proved every bit as volatile as Hamilton had long ago alleged. He rejected Hamilton's pamphlet as being written from his mere imagination, from confused rumors or downright false information. He was not content to undo the work of the pamphlet and again stooped to personal characterizations as spiteful as anything Hamilton had written against him. He again criticized him for being foreign-born, for knowing nothing of the American character, for not being a real patriot, for being an incorrigible rake, for being immature, for lacking military knowledge, even for being a shiftless Treasury secretary who spent his time scribbling ambitious reports while underlings carried out the real departmental business. Like most people, Hamilton and Adams were preternaturally sensitive to flaws in the other that they themselves possessed. For all their fratricidal warfare, the Federalists ran a surprisingly close race for the presidency. Jefferson and Burr tied with 73 electoral votes apiece, while Adams and Pinckney trailed with 65 and 64 votes respectively. As expected, New England unanimously backed Adams, while Jefferson captured virtually the entire South. The New York City elections in April 1800, which had pitted Hamilton against Burr in riveting political drama, had the expected decisive influence. New York cast its 12 electoral votes in a solid block for the Republican ticket, giving it the edge. David McCullough has noted the rich irony that Jefferson, the apostle of agrarian America who loathed cities, owed his ultimate political triumph to New York. But John Adams never doubted that Hamilton's pamphlet had dealt a fatal blow to his candidacy. He later said, "If the single purpose had been to defeat the president, no more propitious moment could have been chosen." On another occasion, Adams said that Hamilton and his band had killed themselves and indicted me for the murder. Scholars have questioned the pamphlet's direct impact on the vote. In many of the 16 states, electors had been chosen by state legislatures whose composition had been determined long before Hamilton perpetrated his pamphlet. And the results in states that had not yet selected their electors did not deviate significantly from earlier predictions. Hamilton had hoped that his efforts might boost Charles C. Pinckney in his native South Carolina, but Republicans swept the state. Many observers thought Hamilton had frittered away his prestige and that his letter had backfired. "I do not believe it has altered a single vote in the late election," Robert Troup remarked, adding that it had exposed Hamilton's character, not Adams's, as radically deficient in discretion. The Federalists had not dropped votes for Adams to install Pinckney as president, as Hamilton had urged, a precipitous fall from grace for Hamilton as he lost his luster and once unchallenged power over Federalist colleagues. However peripheral in the election, Hamilton's letter almost certainly hastened the collapse of the Federalists as a national political force. Adams was certain that Hamilton's ambition, intrigues, and caucuses have ruined the cause of federalism. The Federalists lingered for another decade or two, but outside of New England, they were a spent force. Their decline eliminated any chance that Hamilton would ever regain a top post, much less the presidency. Why did Hamilton contribute to this disarray among the Federalists? As usual, he thought the country was careening toward a national emergency, either a French invasion or a civil war, and was convinced that Adams would adulterate federalism. Better to purge Adams and let Jefferson govern for a while than to water down the party's ideological purity with compromises. If the cause is to be sacrificed to a weak and perverse man, Hamilton said of Adams's leadership of the Federalists, I withdraw from the party and act upon my own ground. Doubtless Hamilton thought that he could pick up the pieces of a shattered Federalist party. What he overlooked was that in trying to wreck Adams's career, he would wreck his own, and that the Federalists would never be resurrected from the ashes. The personal recriminations of the 1800 election can obscure the huge ideological shift that reshaped American politics and made the Republicans the majority party. In races for the House of Representatives, where Hamilton's letter played no part, the Republicans took control by a more lopsided margin, 65 Republicans to 41 Federalists, than in their presidential victory. The people had registered their dismay with a long litany of unpopular Federalist actions. The Jay Treaty, the Alien and Sedition Acts, the truculent policy toward France, the vast army being formed under Hamilton, and the taxes levied to support it. The 1800 elections revealed for the first time the powerful centrist pull of American politics, the electorate's tendency to rein in anything perceived as extreme. The stress placed upon the Adams-Hamilton feud pointed up a deeper problem in the Federalist Party, one that may explain its ultimate failure to survive, the elitist nature of its politics. James McHenry bemoaned to Oliver Wolcott Jr. of their adherence, "They write private letters to each other, but do nothing to give a proper direction to the public mind." The Federalists issued appeals to the electorate, but did not try to mobilize a broad-based popular movement. Hamilton wanted to lead the electorate and provide expert opinion instead of consulting popular opinion. He took tough, uncompromising stands and gloried in abstruse ideas in a political culture that pined for greater simplicity. Alexander Hamilton triumphed as a doer and thinker, not as a leader of the average voter. He was simply too unashamedly brainy to appeal to the masses. Fisher Ames observed of Hamilton that the common people don't want leaders whom they see elevated by nature and education so far above their heads. The intellectual spoilsport among the founding fathers, Hamilton never believed in the perfectibility of human nature and regularly violated what became the first commandment of American politics. Thou shalt always be optimistic when addressing the electorate. He shrank from the campaign rhetoric that flattered Americans as the most wonderful, enlightened people on earth and denied that they had anything to learn from European societies. He was incapable of the resolutely uplifting themes that were to become mandatory in American politics. The first great skeptic of American exceptionalism, he refused to believe that the country was exempt from the sober lessons of history. Where Hamilton looked at the world through a dark filter and had a better sense of human limitations, Jefferson viewed the world through a rose-colored prism and had a better sense of human potentialities. Both Hamilton and Jefferson believed in democracy, but Hamilton tended to be more suspicious of the governed and Jefferson of the governors. A strange blend of dreamy idealist and manipulative politician, Jefferson was a virtuoso of the sunny phrases and hopeful themes that became staples of American politics. He continually paid homage to the wisdom of the masses. Before the 1800 election, Federalist Harrison Gray Otis saw Jefferson's approach as a very sweet-smelling incense which flattery offers to vanity and folly at the shrine of falsehood. John Quincy Adams also explained Jefferson's presidential triumph by saying that he had been pimping to the popular passions. To Jefferson, we owe the self-congratulatory language of 4th of July oratory, the evangelical conviction that America serves as a beacon to all humanity. Jefferson told John Dickinson, Our revolution and its consequences will ameliorate the condition of man over a great portion of the globe. At least on paper, Jefferson possessed a more all-embracing view of democracy than Hamilton, who was always frightened by a sense of the fickle and fallible nature of the masses. Having said that, one must add that the celebration of the 1800 election as the simple triumph of progressive Jeffersonians over reactionary Hamiltonians greatly overstates the case. The three terms of Federalist rule had been full of dazzling accomplishments that Republicans, with their extreme apprehension of federal power, could never have achieved. Under the tutelage of Washington, Adams, and Hamilton, the Federalists had bequeathed to American history a sound federal government with a central bank, a funded debt, a high credit rating, a tax system, a customs service, a coast guard, a navy, and many other institutions that would guarantee the strength to preserve liberty. They activated critical constitutional doctrines that gave the American Charter flexibility, forged the bonds of nationhood, and lent an energetic tone to the executive branch in foreign and domestic policy. Hamilton, in particular, bound the nation through his fiscal programs in a way that no Republican could have matched. He helped to establish the rule of law and the culture of capitalism at a time when a revolutionary utopianism and a flirtation with the French Revolution still prevailed among too many Jeffersonians. With their reverence for states' rights, abhorrence of central authority, and cramped interpretation of the Constitution, Republicans would have found it difficult, if not impossible, to achieve these historic feats. Hamilton had promoted a forward-looking agenda of a modern nation-state with a market economy and an affirmative view of central government. His meritocratic vision allowed greater scope in the economic sphere for the individual liberties that Jefferson defended so eloquently in the political sphere. It was no coincidence that the allegedly aristocratic and reactionary Federalists contained the overwhelming majority of active abolitionists of the period. Elitists they might be, but they constituted an open, fluid elite based on merit and money, not on birth and breeding, the antithesis of the Southern plantation system. It was the Northern economic system that embodied the mix of democracy and capitalism that was to constitute the essence of America in the long run. By no means did the 1800 election represent the unalloyed triumph of good over evil or of commoners over the well-born. The 1800 triumph of republicanism also meant the ascendancy of the slave-holding South. Three Virginia slaveholders, Jefferson, Madison, and Monroe, were to control the White House for the next 24 years. These aristocratic exponents of democracy not only owned hundreds of human beings, but profited from the Constitution's least democratic features: the legality of slavery and the ability of Southern states to count 3/5 of their captive populations in calculating their electoral votes. Without this so-called federal ratio, John Adams would have defeated Thomas Jefferson in 1800. The Constitution did more than just tolerate slavery. It actively rewarded it. Timothy Pickering was to inveigh against Negro presidents and Negro Congresses. That is, presidents and Congresses who owed their power to the 3/5 rule. This bias inflated Southern power against the North and disfigured the democracy so proudly proclaimed by the Jeffersonians. Slaveholding presidents from the South occupied the presidency for approximately 50 of the 72 years following Washington's first inauguration. Many of these slaveholding populists were celebrated by posterity as tribunes of the common people. Meanwhile, the self-made Hamilton, a fervent abolitionist and a staunch believer in meritocracy, was villainized in American history textbooks as an apologist of privilege and wealth. Chapter 37. Deadlock. Hamilton, Adams, and other Federalists had proved far more realistic about the course of the French Revolution than their credulous Republican counterparts. On dozens of occasions, Hamilton had prophesied that the revolutionary chaos would culminate in a dictatorship. This forecast had been borne out on November 9, 1799, when Napoleon Bonaparte grabbed power in a coup d'etat that made him first consul of the French Republic. When Talleyrand, the eternal foreign minister, declared that it was time to settle differences with America, Napoleon agreed. On October 3, 1800, the American envoys concluded a treaty with France at Chateau Mortefontaine, ending the quasi-war that had so bedeviled the Adams presidency. Most Americans had grown tired of the undeclared war and were happy to close this chapter. The diplomatic breakthrough was not reported in American newspapers until November, and the treaty itself arrived at the Senate in mid-December. Unlike many die-hard Federalists, Hamilton favored the treaty, or at least realized the futility of opposing it, telling Governor Morris that it will be of consequence to the federal cause in future to be able to say, "The federal administration steered the vessel through all the storms raised by the contentions of Europe into a peaceable and safe port." Hamilton was, shall we say, a belated convert to this more peaceable approach to the conflict. For John Adams, who had defied the High Federalists and stuck to his policy, it was a stunning vindication of his stubborn faith in diplomacy against Hamilton's saber-rattling. He established a vital precedent that timely, well-executed diplomacy can forestall the need for military force. In fact, Adams had won such a major diplomatic victory that many historians have tended to condone the antic, unreasonable behavior that preceded it. Even Hamilton biographer Broadus Mitchell has called Adams the hero of the peace. His annoying inconsistencies drop away because when resolution was needed, he was right. He saved the country from war with France, as Hamilton and others had saved it shortly before from war with Britain. Adams described the preservation of peace during his presidency as the most splendid diamond in my crown, and requested that the following words be incised on his tombstone: "Here lies John Adams, who took upon himself the responsibility of peace with France in the year 1800. Adams later cited the diabolical intrigues of Hamilton and his colleagues, contending that he had pursued negotiations with France at the expense of all my consequence in the world and their unanimous and immortal hatred. Adams's success came too late to sway the presidential election, and therefore bore a bittersweet flavor. The bad timing only exacerbated his sense of being unlucky, unloved, and unappreciated. His admirers have echoed his view that he had acted in a noble, self-sacrificing manner, but his motives were not entirely saintly. He had adopted a hawkish stance toward France when that was popular early in his administration, and then taken a more conciliatory posture to curry favor with Republicans as the 1800 election beckoned. By that point, his moderation was popular with electors in some critical states. George Clinton said that Adams, having sent a special mission to France and effected a peace, came very near preventing the election of Mr. Jefferson to the presidency. If the Republicans had not already named Jefferson for president, we should have supported Mr. Adams. The peace mission to France was unquestionably the supreme triumph of the Adams presidency, but it testifies to political agility as well as wisdom. By mid-December 1800, it was evident that Jefferson and Burr would garner an equal number of electoral votes, throwing the presidential contest into a lame-duck House of Representatives that was still dominated by Federalists. While no constitutional mechanism differentiated between the votes for president and vice president, it had been understood among Republicans that Jefferson was the presidential candidate. Afraid of jeopardizing Burr's chances for the vice presidency, Jefferson had held back from asking Republican electors to drop a few votes for Burr to ensure that he himself would come out on top. At first, Burr reacted to the tie vote in a gracious, honorable way, just as Jefferson had expected. He wrote to Republican Samuel Smith and renounced the sacrilegious thought of challenging Jefferson for the presidency. "It is highly improbable that I shall have an equal number of votes with Mr. Jefferson, but if such should be the result, every man who knows me ought to know that I should utterly disclaim all competition." At least one knowledgeable observer doubted that Burr's intentions were quite so benign. Hamilton was privy to rumors that Federalists in Congress might prefer Burr to Jefferson. So when he learned of the projected tie vote, he fired off a letter to Oliver Wolcott Jr. to nip trouble in the bud. "As to Burr, there is nothing in his favor. His private character is not defended by his most partial friends. He is bankrupt beyond redemption, except by the plunder of his country. His public principles have no other spring or aim than his own aggrandizement. If he can, he will certainly disturb our institutions to secure to himself permanent power, and with it, wealth. He is truly the Catiline of America." This was a powerful indictment. In ancient Rome, Catiline was notorious for his personal dissipation and treacherous schemes to undermine the Republic. In order to stop Burr, Hamilton decided to back his perpetual rival, Thomas Jefferson, telling Wolcott that Jefferson is by far not so dangerous a man, and he has pretensions to character. He also thought that Jefferson was much more talented than the overrated Burr, and that the latter was far more cunning than wise, far more dexterous than able. In my opinion, he is inferior in real ability to Jefferson. Hamilton's endorsement of Jefferson was the most improbable reversal in an improbable career. Nobody enjoyed Hamilton's embarrassing predicament in having to choose between his two enemies more than John Adams. The very man, the very two men, of all the world that he was most jealous of, are now placed above him, Adams said with pardonable gloating. Even in the thick of the campaign that summer, Hamilton had noted Burr's electoral intrigues in New Jersey, Rhode Island, and Vermont, and surmised that he was only feigning deference to Jefferson. Burr alone had engaged in open electioneering, while Jefferson, Adams, and Pinckney stuck to the gentlemanly protocol of avoiding the stump. The alliance between Burr and Jefferson had been a marriage of convenience to pull New York into the Republican camp. "I never indeed thought him an honest, frank-dealing man," Jefferson later said of Burr, "but considered him as a crooked gun or other perverted machine, whose aim or shot you could never be sure of." That Jefferson twice recruited this crooked gun for his running mate indicates just how cynical he could be. Burr, in turn, still believed that he had been betrayed by Jefferson in the 1796 election, when he got only one vote in Virginia. "As to my Jeff," he wrote with mordant whimsy, "after what happened at the last election, et tu, Brute, I was really averse to having my name in question, but being so, it is most obvious that I should not choose to be trifled with." Despite Burr's declaration that he would yield the presidency to Jefferson, Federalist leaders pelted Hamilton with letters about the expediency of supporting Burr and ending Virginia's political hegemony. Because Burr lusted after money and power, they thought they could strike a bargain with him. They worried less about Burr's loose morals than about what they perceived as Jefferson's atheism. Clergymen were telling their congregations that if Jefferson became president, they would need to hide their Bibles and his doctrinaire views. Better an opportunist than a dangerous ideologue, many Federalists thought. Fisher Ames feared that Jefferson was absurd enough to believe his own nonsense, while Burr might at least impart vigor to the country. John Marshall and others thought Burr a safer choice than Jefferson, who might try to recast the Constitution to conform to his Jacobin tenets. If forced to choose, Hamilton preferred a man with wrong principles to one devoid of any. "There is no circumstance which has occurred in the course of our political affairs that has given me so much pain as the idea that Mr. Burr might be elevated to the presidency by the means of the Federalists," Hamilton told Wolcott. If the party elected Burr, it would be exposed to the disgrace of a defeat in an attempt to elevate to the first place in the government one of the worst men in the community. Hamilton had never spoken about Adams and Jefferson in these terms. "The appointment of Burr as president would disgrace our country abroad," he informed Sedgwick. "No agreement with him could be relied upon." Unlike other Federalists, Hamilton did not think Burr would be a harmless, lackadaisical president. "He is sanguine enough to hope everything, daring enough to attempt everything, wicked enough to scruple nothing," Hamilton told Governor Morris. From his legal practice, Hamilton knew that Burr had exorbitant debts and might be susceptible to bribes from foreign governments. He briefed Federalists about the scandals involving Burr and the Holland Company and the gross trickery behind the Manhattan Company. While Inspector General, Hamilton had had a disturbing conversation with Burr that he now repeated to Robert Troop and two other friends. "General, you are now at the head of the army," Burr had told him. "You are a man of the first talents and of vast influence. Our Constitution is a miserable paper machine. You have it in your power to demolish it and give us a proper one, and you owe it to your friends and the country to do it. To which Hamilton said, he replied, "Why, Colonel Burr, in the first place, the little army I command is totally inadequate to the object you mention. And in the second place, if the army were adequate, I am too much troubled with that thing called morality to make the attempt." Reverting to French, Burr pooh-poohed this timidity. "General, all things are moral to great souls." So unalterably opposed was Hamilton to Burr that he told Federalist friends that he would withdraw from the party or even from public life if they installed Burr as president. By endorsing Burr, he warned, the Federalists would be signing their own death warrant. Hamilton feared that Burr might supplant him as de facto party head, or might even foster a third party composed of disenchanted elements from the other two. Either way, Hamilton feared he would be shunted aside. Had he risked his career to block Adams's re-election only to have Aaron Burr fill the void? By late December 1800, as Hamilton had forewarned, Burr changed his mind. He would not seek the presidency, but neither would he reject it if the House chose him over Jefferson. End of Disc 25.